Hello and welcome to this news conference sponsored by Physicians for Social Responsibility. You'll be hearing from four speakers today. Before we introduce them individually, I'm going to bring the operator on the line to explain how the Q&A period will work. Operator?
During the question and answer session, you may ask a question by pressing star, then one on your touch-tone phone. If you would like to remove yourself from the queue, you can press star, then two. Again, it's star, then one to ask a question.
Thank you. And we will repeat those instructions about how members of the media can pose questions at the start of the Q&A period. As I mentioned, you'll be hearing from four speakers today. First, Catherine Thomason, MD, report co-editor and executive director, Physicians for Social Responsibility. Second, Dr. Alex Rosen, pediatrician and vice chair, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. Third, Tim Musso, PhD, Professor of Biological Sciences, University of South Carolina. And fourth, Robert Alvarez, Senior Scholar specializing in nuclear disarmament, environmental, and energy policies, Institute for Public Studies, and former Senior Policy Advisor, U.S. Department of Energy. So let's begin with our first speaker, Catherine Thomason, MD, report co-author and executive director, Physicians for Social Responsibility. Catherine.
Thank you. Welcome so much to this news conference being held to release the report, 5 years of Living with Fukushima, which is the work of Physicians for Social Responsibility and the International Physicians for Prevention of Nuclear War. On behalf of my organization and our international group, IPPNW, I want to thank you for joining us today. As you'll hear, our report concludes that residents of the Fukushima area and the rest of Japan will experience more than 10 to 66,000 excess cancers as a result of a radiation exposure from the triple reactor meltdown that took place on March 11, 2011. Unfortunately, the full health impact of Fukushima may never be known due to Japan's failure to immediately and fully track radiation releases, as well as a disturbing lack of testing of the general population for radiation-related diseases and other impacts, such as miscarriages, fetal malformations, leukemia, lymphomas, solid tumors, or cardiovascular disease. The massive initial radioactive emissions were not recorded at the time of the triple reactor meltdown, and some radioactive isotopes, including strontium-90, have not been measured at all by the government. Our new report uses the best available science and data to gauge the excess cancer rates among children, rescue and cleanup workers, and the general population of Japan. In addition to the 200,000 Fukushima residents who were evacuated into nearby makeshift camps, the exposed include millions of others in Japan as a result of fallout-contaminated food, soil, and water. Our next speaker will go through the report's clear findings in more detail. But I want to emphasize that Fukushima is often incorrectly seen as a past event. The reality is that radioactive emissions from the wrecked reactors continue to this day, both periodically into the atmosphere and in the form of 300 tons of leakage each day into the Pacific Ocean. 5 years living with Fukushima draws clear and clean conclusions that, given the large amount of radiation released, that calculated cancer risk is clear. The report also asks vital questions about the impacts and calls for better study, evaluation, and treatment of those affected. Health problems will not be identified if they're not sought. The problem with radiation is that the average person can't see it, taste it, or smell it, but you can measure it. Some radioactive particles have radiation that penetrate through the skin like an X-ray, such as barium and cesium. So having these particles on the ground or in the air exposes people to radiation that can cause damage to our DNA and our cell proteins. Other particles, like iodine-131 or cesium-137, have beta and or alpha radiation, which can be stopped by clothing or alpha radiation by skin. If these particles enter the body, however, when they're inhaled or ingested with contaminated food, then the radiation is able to cause local tissue damage, including damaging our genetic material or even causing cell death, depending on where those particles or elements are in the body. Cesium is exchangeable with potassium, which is found in all ourselves and is taken up more avidly by muscle, particularly including cardiac muscle and endocrine tissues. Strontium 90 takes the place of calcium and can be embedded in bones and teeth. The Japanese government attempted to clean up areas that were contaminated by wiping down buildings, gathering up abandoned crops and topsoil so that people could return to their homes, their farms, their jobs, and way of life. But this expensive, over $13.5 billion effort has not been fully effective. There are many areas that cannot be cleaned up, such as forests, and the tons of storage needed for the leaves and debris is a very difficult one. Radiation that was deposited on the ground percolates through the soil into groundwater. It can be taken up in food and is then ingested by those living in these areas. People across Japan are concerned, as many were also exposed. For example, an area such as the tea plantations in Shizuoka Prefecture, which was 400 kilometers south of Fukushima and 140 kilometers from Tokyo, were so heavily contaminated that the entire harvest was withdrawn from market in 2011. In closing, I would like to say this. The health legacy of Fukushima will haunt Japan for years to come, and it cannot be wished out of existence by cheerleaders for nuclear power. Unfortunately, the pro-nuclear Japanese government and the country's influential nuclear lobby are doing everything in their power to downplay and conceal the effects of the disaster. The high numbers of thyroid cancers are already verified, with 50 additional waiting for surgery in the children of Fukushima Prefecture is astounding. The aim seems to be to ensure the Fukushima file is closed as soon as possible, and the Japanese public returns to a positive view of nuclear power. This hasty and ill-thought-out rush to re-embrace nuclear power is dangerous to the extent that it sweeps major and very real medical concerns under the rug. That concludes my opening statement, and I look forward to taking your questions in the Q&A session.
Again, that was Catherine Thomason, MD, report co-editor and executive director, Physicians for Social Responsibility. Let's proceed to our second speaker, Dr. Alex Rosen, pediatrician and vice chair, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War.
Hello. As one of the co-authors of the report, I think it is important to realize for everyone that has read this report that obviously 5 years after the beginning of the nuclear catastrophe in Fukushima, it is not possible to give an overall assessment of the health effects that are to be expected. It is much too early for that, and many of the health effects that we will be seeing, we expect in the coming years and decades. We don't pretend to have the better answers, but we do know that we ask some of the better questions, the more critical questions. Questions such as, what actually happened? We know for a fact that through the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant disaster in 2011, enormous amounts of radioactivity were released into the environment. We know that foodstuffs were radioactively contaminated, as well as water and soil. We know that all of these substances cause cancer, and we know much more about how they do that than we did 30 years ago when Chernobyl happened. We know that the risk of disease, cancer and non-cancerous disease, is proportional to the amount of radiation dose that a person receives. So the question really is, can we calculate this this risk, this number of additional cancer cases that will appear due to the Fukushima nuclear catastrophe? And this is what we attempted to do in our report based on the findings, for example, by the WHO, the World Health Organization, or the United Nations. Now, if you take the numbers by the United Nations, they say that the population in Japan was exposed to 48,000 per sievert. This is a unit describing the amount of radiation. Then you can calculate from that that about 10,000 cases of excess cases of cancer will be expected in this population over the lifetime. If you take the WHO data, you come to even higher numbers, between 22 and 66,000 additional cases of cancer. Now, all of these numbers are estimates, and they're not good estimates. They are underestimations because the numbers and the data they're based on come solely from the nuclear industry. If you look at the radiation doses of the workers in the plant, they come from TEPCO. If you look at the radiation dose of contaminated food, they come from the International Atomic Energy Organization. And if you look at the amount of radiation that was released in total, that comes from the Japanese Atomic Energy Agency. So in our view, these numbers represent the lower spectrum of the estimates, and we expect there to be a much greater number of excess cancer cases. And the same is true for non-cancer diseases, such as cardiovascular diseases. We know from our findings of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki survivors that the risk of contracting cardiovascular disease has about similar risk factors compared to the amount of radiation received as cancer. So we're counting on a similar amount of non-cancer diseases to come out of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. What we already see today, 5 years after the nuclear catastrophe began, is a rise in the amount of thyroid cancers amongst children. We now have 160 children who have to be operated on, meaning that their thyroid had to be removed because of a fast-growing cancer or cancer that had already spread to the lymph nodes and other organs. Usually, this type of cancer is very, very rare in children. In Japan, we are in the pre-Fukushima era, we had about 0.3 cases of thyroid cancer per 100,000 children per year. So in this population that was evaluated in the Fukushima prefecture, we would expect there to be about one new case per year. So far in the last 5 years, we have found 116. And what is most worrying is that in 16 of these children, the cancer developed in the last 2 years. We know this because these children have been screened twice. In the first ultrasound of the thyroid, no cancer was found, and in the second one, they found a cancer that had to be operated on. So we're talking about a significantly increased rate of new thyroid cancer cases in the last couple of years, and expect from our experience from Chernobyl and other incidences of nuclear accidents that the greatest number of thyroid cancer cases is still to come. Based on the data of the United Nations, we are counting on more than 1,000 excess cases of thyroid cancer amongst children. So looking at all of these facts and these numbers, it's important for us as doctors to state that every human being has a right to health and to life in a healthy environment. And this is our big problem, that we're seeing that this right is being taken away from people, people who are living in contaminated areas, people who are forced to eat contaminated food. So the important thing about this report is not so much counting cases of cancer or making the best prediction of how many cases of cancer there will be, but pointing out that there are people in Japan right now whose right to life in a healthy environment is being taken away from them. And I look forward to your questions in the Q&A period. Thank you very much.
Again, that was Dr. Alex Rosen, pediatrician and vice chair, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. It takes us to our third speaker, Tim Musso, PhD, professor of biological sciences, University of South Carolina.
Oh, very good. Very nice to be here. I'm going to pick up where Alex left off and focus particularly on the impacts to environmental systems and environmental effects on non-human biota. You know, over the last decade or so, there's been a huge growth in the research findings published in peer-reviewed scientific journals concerning the impacts of radiation to both the plant and animal populations of both Fukushima and Chernobyl. And in some, these studies indicate really an ongoing threat to the ecosystems of these regions. Studies of birds in both regions indicate declining populations stemming from the effects of radiation on reproductive ability and other diseases. Recent studies of Japanese macaques suggest radiation effects on components of the monkey's blood that are similar to that previously reported for children living in Chernobyl-affected regions of Ukraine and Belarus. There have been a growing number of studies of insects that suggest that some groups, especially butterflies, have been negatively impacted by exposure to the radioactive contaminants. And, you know, experimental studies on these groups have been able to directly demonstrate the mutagenic consequences of the exposure to radiation, and most importantly, that such mutations can be passed from one generation to the next. A very important finding from a long-term perspective. There was a recent report just in the past few months on Japanese fir trees that suggests damage to growing regions of these trees that are very similar to those that have been found for pine trees in Chernobyl, leading to this twisted and abnormal growth form that dramatically reduces the economic value of these trees. But more importantly, really, it's a bioindicator of the effects of radiation in the broader environment that really needs to be reckoned with. So overall, you know, the many parallels that are now being found between the effects of both radiation effects of in both Chernobyl and Fukushima provides, you know, quite strong and compelling scientific evidence that the threats posed by radionuclides in the environment are real and of significant concern for the long-term sustainability of these ecosystems. You know, this growing scientific literature stands in stark contrast to the unrealistically optimistic and to my mind, largely unsubstantiated claims by recent UNSCAR and IEA reports that suggest that there would be little to no impacts to the Fukushima or Chernobyl biota stemming from these disasters. Clearly, the recent findings contradict those official positions. Really, you know, a greater concern, I think, is that there's this grossly inadequate investment in basic ecological research by either the Japanese government or the international community into these broader environmental effects. You know, natural systems really provide a bellwether, a canary in the coal mine, as it were, for the potential long-term consequences for human populations that, you know, by necessity and government policy continue to inhabit regions of Japan, Ukraine, Belarus, Russia, the U.S., and many other parts of the world. And, you know, these studies of natural biota offer so many advantages over studies of humans in that lifespans are much shorter, they can be studied in areas of much higher contamination, and they can be experimentally manipulated. Thus, effects, if any, can be observed quickly, and the mechanisms of cause and effect can be directly tested in many cases. So they really do provide an opportunity to get at the underlying mechanisms associated with radiation exposure that are likely to be of great interest to issues related to human health as well. Clearly, further research is warranted. Thank you very much.
Again, that was Tim Musso, PhD, Professor of Biological Sciences, University of South Carolina. And let's proceed to our fourth speaker, Robert Alvarez, Senior Scholar specializing in nuclear disarmament, environmental, and energy policies, Institute for Public Studies, and former Senior Policy Advisor, U.S. Department of Energy, Environmental Advocate, of Energy. Go ahead, Robert.
Thank you. I will be speaking to the matter of land contamination and its impact on the people. The accident, according to the Japanese Science Ministry, reported that long-lived radioactive cesium, as Susan has pointed out, had contaminated about 11,580 square miles of the land surface of Japan and about 4,500 square miles, an area about almost the size of Connecticut, was found to have radiation levels that exceeded U.S. Exposure limits to the public by a factor of 4 to 6. All of the land within 12 miles of the destroyed nuclear site, encompassing an area about 230 square miles and an additional 80 square miles located northwest of the plant, were declared too radioactive for human habitation. And all the people living in these areas were evacuated, and regions were declared to be permanent exclusion zones. This meant that about 160,000 people were displaced due to radioactive contamination. They cannot return. Each day now, the reactors 1 through 3, we now know that the reactor cores have melted down through the bottom of the reactor, and we currently lack the technology to even observe what is going on inside these reactors because of the intense radiation fields. They have made some progress and have been removing spent nuclear fuel from unit number 4, which did not experience the kind of significant damage as the other reactors. Each day, hundreds of tons of water are poured upon the melted cores, which flow into a nearby reactor turbine building, and then it's pumped through extensive cooling system, traps the radioactivity, and filters the size of small cars, which in turn become highly radioactive, are being placed in a nearby field. Approximately 1 million gallons of highly radioactive water have already been collected and are stored in the site in over 1,000 large tanks. And about 400 tons of groundwater continually flow through the damaged reactor buildings and then continue to flow into the ocean, which guarantees that the aquatic life that's used for human consumption in that immediate area will be off limits for an indefinite period of time. The economic costs of this tragedy is still being figured out, but right now the estimates for restoring the site to some sort of some restricted use. I mean, you have to consider what the site and then perhaps the largely contaminated exclusion zone may have to be considered sacrifice areas for indefinite periods of time. But right now, the current estimates for perhaps doing remediation of the site are somewhere in a range of $50 to $100 billion. Tokyo Electric Power has received about $100 billion in the form of subsidies and payments for electrical bills from the consumer as a means to keep them afloat. The precise value of the abandoned cities, towns, agricultural lands, businesses, homes, and property located within this 310 square miles of the exclusion zone has not been established, but the total economic losses range from as high as $500 billion. Now, what does that mean? Well, the costs for the damage caused by the hurricanes Katrina and Sandy in this country in 2005 and 2013 combined are about less than three times the amount of projected economic damage that this reactor tragedy has created. These 160,000 people who've been evicted from their homes have lost their homes and virtually all their possessions, and most have received only small compensation to cover their costs of living as evacuees, and they don't know if their homes will ever be again habitable. And areas with significantly contaminated with radioactive cesium and other long-lived radionuclides can no longer sell or export agricultural crops. So this is something that's going to become a new normal, unfortunately, for the people of Japan, especially in that region. And that concludes my statement.
Again, that was Robert Alvarez, senior scholar specializing in nuclear disarmament, environmental and energy policies, Institute for Public Studies, and former senior policy advisor, U.S. Department of Energy. And that takes us to the Q&A portion of the call. I want to emphasize that the Q&A period is for reporters only. We will be joined by an additional speaker for this portion of the call, Dr. Yuri Hiranuma, radiation and health consultant, Physicians for Social Responsibility. So at this time, I'm going to bring the operator back on the line to explain once again how members of the media may ask a question. Operator?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. If you decide to withdraw your question, please press star then two to remove yourself from the list. Please limit yourself to one question and a single follow-up. If you need to ask an additional question, please know that you may press star then one to rejoin the queue.
Okay, and while we're waiting for our first question, I just want to make sure that reporters know that if they wish to connect with any of the speakers you're hearing from following this call, contact Max Carlin at 703 276-3255. Okay, operator, let's start with our first question.
First question comes from Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Hello, and good morning or afternoon to each of you. My question is, with the unreliability and perhaps the planned deniability of no research being done in the earliest days of the Fukushima disaster and actually for the time after that, where did you source your data? How did you collect it, and how reliable do you feel that it is, or how did you figure out the reliability of it?
I think I will answer that. Well, this is exactly one of the problems that we were facing in putting together this report, and I briefly mentioned it. Most of the data that's available for such calculation come from the company, TEPCO, from the Japanese Atomic Energy Agency, and from the International Atomic Energy Agency. So we're very aware of the problem that this poses, because obviously these three groups have a vested interest in nuclear energy in Japan, and their data, if we look at it, for example, the source term, meaning the total amount of radioactivity released by the nuclear catastrophe, there's several estimations on how large the source term actually was, on how much radioactivity was released, and the Japanese Atomic Energy Agency's estimate actually is the lowest one of them. For independent research by the Norwegian Institute of Atmospheric Studies or the Austrian Central Agency for Atmospheric Studies were not taken into account. Rather, the lowest estimate by the Japanese Atomic Energy Agency was taken up by the United Nations, but also by the WHO report. Still, we went with their numbers because they were the numbers that were published internationally and are talked about. But we realized that because of these vested interests that exist from the companies that are supplying the data or the institutions supplying the data, and that the numbers that we're calculating are basically on the lower spectrum of what we are of what we can expect. And so this is talked about a lot in the report, and it's a good point to always ask, you know, where is the data coming from, and we need to take a careful look at that, and we would wish for there to be more independent research by scientists who don't go not under the suspicion of receiving funds or belonging to the nuclear industry, but sadly, as you mentioned in your question, this data is very rare.
I just may add, this just as an aside, Japan is the second largest contributor to the IAEA budget to the United States.
And is there any way to possibly reconstruct this information, or we have to go with the presumably low estimates that have come out as the basis for this? And even given the low nature of the source material, it still seems like it's a pretty terrible prognosis that you have for Japan and its people.
Well, like I said, we don't pretend to have better answers, but we do think that we have better questions. You know, we don't want to go into number meddling and, you know, taking variables and multiplying them by risk factors and in the end coming up with outrageously high numbers that we can't prove. We'd rather take the numbers that are used by official institutions that they cannot prove, and ask critical questions about how they came about and if they really represent the true extent. What we know is that they most probably do not represent the true extent of the health effects, and that these health effects are much, much larger in scope. But even citing their official statistics, their official data, already paints a picture that is not too positive, and a picture that is worrying a lot of people. So we feel that as an institution like IPPNW and PSR, what we can do is ask critical questions, and this is what we're doing in our report.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And we do want to make sure that the media knows where to get more information about today's news conference following the event. So as I said before, you can connect with any of the speakers you've heard from today or get more information about today's news conference by calling Max Carlin at 703-276-3255. And a streaming audio replay of the news event is going to be available online later today. It'll be at www.psr.org/Fukushima Report 2016. That's www.psr.org/Fukushima Report 2016. Just to make sure that reporters have a chance to get to their questions, I'm going to invite the operator back on once again to remind members of the media how they may ask a question. Operator?
As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, you may press star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. To remove yourself from the queue, you can press star, then 2. Again, it is star, then 1 to ask a question.
Okay. I know that some reporters are going to want to take their questions off the call. So again, just contact Max Carlin with questions or the need to connect with one of the speakers you're hearing from today, 703-276-3255. You've been listening to a news conference sponsored by Physicians for Social Responsibility. We thank you for joining us, and that concludes today's news event.